This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
All right, let's pick up with the practice of prayer and fasting. Jewish daily prayers that we find in synagogue practice, and those that were found to be valued to the Jews were continued to be practiced by the Jewish believers. We have pictures in the New Testament, for example, of specific times in which the believers would pray. Would go to prayer. Continuing with the Jewish practice in Acts chapter 3, it talks about at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, at the hour of prayer, we went to the temple. Or at noon, you have Peter going to the roof to pray, which almost seems to indicate this was part of his normal practice. Or in Acts chapter 16, it's at midnight, and they're praying together. Now, the Didache talks about the importance of praying the Lord's Prayer, and it gives this direction. Recite the Lord's Prayer three times a day. And you have kind of that pattern of the cycle of three times a day. Now, Psalm 55, it talked about three times a day shall I praise Him. And in Daniel chapter 6, you may recall that Daniel's practice was to pray three different times during the day. And so there seemed to be kind of a biblical pattern here that some of the early Christians would pray at particular times, both praise and petition. Prayer was very important as they would gather together, as we've already talked about today, when the believers would get together, obviously a part of worship. Prayers related to the Eucharist, and even on the day of Pentecost, what were they doing? When the Spirit was poured out, they were gathered together in prayer. And Jesus had given them that example in His own life, not only teaching them the Lord's Prayer, but all those times He went off alone to pray. Now, I think the apostles caught it by watching Jesus over those 3 years, how important prayer was to the Savior. Now, the Didache not only talks about reciting the Lord's Prayer three times a day, it also gives some directions on fasting. Now, the Jewish practice, don't ask me what the answer to this is, because I don't know that I know. The Jewish practice had been to fast on Mondays and Thursdays. In the Didache, it says fast on Wednesdays and Fridays. You know, and maybe they were just trying to distinguish themselves from the Jews. I don't know. But this twice a week practice of fasting is at least encouraged. And Jesus, you know, had told His disciples, you know, when I'm gone, there'll be a time for you to fast. And there was a connection in the mind of the early Christians between the focus on the solely upon the Lord when persons fast. And we're going to talk about this more when we talk about monasticism. How is it this sense of the importance of fasting was carried over not only from the ancient period, but into the Middle Ages through the monastic practice of prayer. And we'll talk about how prayer continued to be a prominent part of the life of the church. Yeah, from food. Yeah, they probably did drink, you know, water. The Didache doesn't specify. It just says fast on those 2 days. Yeah, that typically was the practice, you know, during that day. Now, once we get to the monastic, you know, practice, they're very explicit about how you were to fast. I mean, in the different rules, they would lay that out. But we would just assume that there was a common understanding about these things. It's just encouraged. It's an important thing to do. And, you know, much of the church would continue this. In Wesley, for example, in the early Methodist societies, fasted once a week, and he believed that was just a part of your walk with the Lord, that you ought to weekly do that kind of thing. So that too is a part of our heritage. And you know, as there's renewed interest in the spiritual disciplines, that gets discussed again, and it's valuable. And perhaps when we look at the monastic heritage, we can reflect on that a little bit more. But prayer and fasting. The pastoral functions. Now here I want to talk about the preaching, the exercise of discipline, and the healing ministry of those called to service in the church, and what evidence we have from the New Testament. Now the sermons in the book of Acts were primarily to Jews or to pagans, and not so much to the Christian community, although Paul's letters were read in the context of Christian worship, and we would assume, following the synagogue pattern, that in addition to reading the Old Testament scriptures in these letters of Paul, that probably the leaders gave an exposition of those of writings and helped the people assimilate that into their lives. We do, though, have in Acts chapter 20 an illustration. It says explicitly that Paul is preaching and he goes on till midnight. And you remember the man that falls asleep and the problem that we have there. But that's the one example, at least in Acts, of actually preaching to believers. The other contexts are more missionary in the book of Acts. But those synagogue services, I think, set the pattern that would be practiced there in terms of preaching. Now, in terms of discipline, we've already made reference to Ananias and Sapphira, Acts chapter 5. You get the picture very clearly. In the book of Acts, this being persons of our word is serious business before God. And while you're certainly not bound to sell your possessions, don't pretend and don't lie to the Holy Spirit, as Peter said to Ananias and Sapphira. I got a feeling that kind of got the early church's attention, you think? Now, Paul's obviously exercises discipline there and encourages it at the church at Corinth, which is pretty strict. In fact, he even says, he's using his apostolic authority, I turn this man, this man that had been living with his mother, he said, I turn him over to Satan. It's hard to think of stronger language than that. And still you have this sense of his long-term desire that there be restoration, but holiness of life was very serious business in the early church, and that continues in the apostolic fathers very clearly. And then you've got those real ominous passages in the book of Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 6 and Hebrews chapter 10, however you take those, the warnings that, is don't fall away. And those that may even give evidence of saving faith, and once they fall away, it's impossible to restore them. And there are all kind of warnings in the New Testament about the importance of holiness of life and being held accountable to that. And the very fact that the early church continued to practice these things is evidence of these patterns of practice being handed down from bishop to bishop. Church leader to church leader. Now what about the healing ministry? What do I mean there? And there I'm talking about the shepherding aspect of caring for the flock. And the book of Acts is full of the pastoral care issues, whether it be the elders, the deacons, and particularly that diaconate role of caring for the people. But you also have a sense that the elders of the church, according to the book of James, have a role of ministry to the sick. In James chapter 5, you've got this exhortation: if any of you is sick, call for the elders, who will anoint with oil and pray for you, and God will heal. And I know a lot of churches practice that literally, and you don't have to be Pentecostal to practice that kind of thing and believe God actually heals people. And I know when I was a pastor, that was one of the most precious opportunities we ever had, either with minister and elders corporately or as a pastor to go into someone's home with someone that was invalid and couldn't even get to church, to go and anoint them with oil and to pray for them. This is a practice that we're encouraged to emulate in the book of James, and there's no reason why we ought not feel free to do that. And that symbolism of the oil with the Spirit, and my practice is usually just the sign of the cross on the forehead and pray with them. You want to pour it on their head, do whatever you feel is appropriate. It doesn't tell you how, it just encourages you to do it. Call for the leaders, and God will bring healing. So that ministry of of healing at the hands of the elders appears to be a continuation of that apostolic practice. Peter and Paul laid their hands on people and they were healed. And that was a part of their ministry, in addition to proclaiming the gospel, that they would be involved in that that ministry, and at least some evidence for the continuation of that in the New Testament. Apostles, prophets, teachers, what do we see in not only the New Testament, but in the Didache? I want to read you a section of the Didache in chapter 11 where it talks about the prophets. And this is a good evidence for the fact that nothing ever really changed. But listen at the advice they give of how to deal with these traveling prophets or evangelists, if you would. This is from, again, chapter 11 in the Didache. "Now you should welcome anyone who comes your way and teaches you all that we have been saying. But if the teacher proves himself a renegade by teaching otherwise and contradicts all this, pay no attention to him. But if his teaching furthers the Lord's righteousness and knowledge, welcome him as the Lord. Now about the apostles and prophets. Act in line with the gospel precept. Welcome every apostle upon arriving." You know, the word apostolos just means the sent ones. And there's still, apparently, when the Didache was written, was this sense that there was still the office of apostle and prophet in their midst, much like we see in the New Testament. This is one of the chief indicators for the dating of this, that they still sense this New Testament practice. The Didache says, "Now about the apostles and prophets, act in line with the gospel concept. Welcome every apostle on arriving as if he were the Lord, but he must not stay beyond one day. In case of necessity, however, the next day too. But if he stays 3 days, he is a false prophet." In other words, don't let the brethren abuse you and take your money and depend on you for their livelihood. If they're taking advantage of the brethren, they're a false prophet. Some of the TV preachers ought to have to read the Didache, you think? "On departing, an apostle must not accept anything except sufficient food to carry him till the next lodging. And then it says, if he asks for money, he is a false prophet." So from the very beginning, they had to be warned about the fact there are some people that are going to try to take advantage of you for their own monetary advantage. And they said, be watchful and be careful about that. But apostles and prophets, they were aware of this office. They talk about deacons, presbyters, but not so much the term bishop yet. That doesn't show up in the Didache, nor does the terminology priest. We'll talk about the evolution of this idea of the priesthood and how it made its way into the church, but that's going to be a bit later. Uh-huh?
Can you make the distinction here with what they meant by apostle?
Yes, I think at this sense, at this point, they had a sense of these missionary persons that are emissaries that come to us, you know, to bring God's message, much like the prophets. I don't know that we could make a hard and fast distinction between prophets and apostles. They don't within the Didache itself. They don't necessarily fine tune that to distinction. But I think if we look at the New Testament usage, as we're most of us are aware, the term apostle is used for more than just a reference to the 12. Paul will talk about so-and-so who is counted among the apostles. And so the term is used more generically than just the 12. And it seems to have the connotation of those who have a missionary kind of calling, who travel or doing evangelistic work, where the notion of the prophet is one who receives messages from God and has a word to speak to the local church bodies, just like the daughters of Philip in the book of Acts, who are prophetesses. And you have the sense that they have a message that they will bring to the church. We're not given a lot of explicit details about these things other than an acknowledgement that these were, at this point, considered to be distinctive offices. Now, By the time you move in the second and third century, you don't hear them talking about prophets and apostles anymore. The forms of church office become established. They're bishops, they're presbyters, and they're deacons. And eventually, they're going to carve up the office of deacon into, you know, about a dozen lower orders of deacons as you move into the third and fourth century. But in this early period, before there are more hard and fast distinctions, the church office and leadership seemed to be rather fluid. And, you know, to fit it within the later church framework explicitly sometimes is difficult to do. Now, one question emerges. What about, was this appointment or by election? Because we find that it appears that Paul, it would talk about him appointing elders and leaders. He took it upon himself as an apostle to appoint leaders in particular areas. But the Didache seems to indicate that some were appointed to office, but some could be chosen by the people. And we see the same thing in the New Testament. So there seems to be a variety of practices. Sometimes they were appointed, sometimes they were elected by the people, or sometimes a combination thereof, where the people would choose and call out the people that they felt like were gifted to this, but then the primary leaders in that particular church would then confirm the choices of the people. Kind of a give and take. So you see just a variety of ways that this was done. But typically there are exhortations about the laying on of hands and being set apart for ministries. But again, kind of a fluid relationship here. And that's going to evolve over the centuries also. You know, who appoints bishops? As you move in the second and third century, you'll see that the people acknowledge and vote and make decisions about who will be bishops. Eventually, as you move closer toward the Middle Ages, it's other bishops who get to decide who the other bishops are and are the ones that lay on hands and that kind of thing. So it's hard to get, and this is the reason, if I could just make this final point, part of the reason we have so much diversity of practice on church government in our Protestant churches, the Bible's not clear. Now, I know as a good Presbyterian, I'm supposed to say, well, the Presbyterian way is absolutely right. What we used to call, as the Puritan said, the divine right of Presbyterianism. All you congregationalists have lost it. And the independents in the Westminster Assembly were irate over these arrogant Presbyterians that believed their form of government was the only way. Well, of course, congregationalism is biblical. And the English, you know, the Anglican Puritans said, well, of course, we've had Episcopal, you know, bishops since the second century. How much longer do you need to have them? And they just could never agree, even within the Westminster Assembly. This was the most contentious issue they faced. They couldn't agree. And we continue not to do that. And I think the easiest answer to that is that the Bible tells us about the offices. It doesn't give us all the details about it. And the practice of the church evolved over time. And, you know, at the Reformation, they began to go back to the drawing board and weren't convinced that necessarily having bishops was absolutely the way we had to practice it. That there ought to be some other ways that we can understand church government. And part of the problem was, you know, bishops can be fine if you have good bishops. But if you have corrupt bishops, it's a disaster for the church. And so when there's mutual accountability, this is the Presbyterian argument. A lot of it was practical as much as it was, quote, biblical. We give one man too much power in the church, and odds are he's going to become corrupt. And how many illustrations of that do we continue to have in the contemporary church? So there's the pragmatic side as much as following Scripture. That's a continuing issue for the church. Gathering for worship, the different ceremonies of music, meeting places. What about marriages and funerals? What did early Christians do? The evidence seems to point to them not only trying to make these events distinctly Christian, but using a lot of the practices that were common to their culture that were not necessarily offensive or undermine Christian principles, much like we do today. And there seemed to be, you know, enough flexibility on that, that the Christians certainly didn't practice a blatant pagan parts of, you know, marriage ceremonies or burials, but weren't opposed to incorporating some that were not as offensive. And I'd say even more than marriage, the burials particularly were uniquely Christian. In fact, one thing that we will see in the period of the persecutions, the pagans began to observe that, you know, these Christians, because of their belief in the resurrection, that we can't believe how they honor the bodies of their dead. And so what the pagans began to do after they realized how important this was, and with the martyrs, whether it be relics or whatever, they carefully buried the bodies because of their belief in the resurrection of the body and that kind of thing. Just to spite the Christians, it became pagan practice after these Christians were killed in the arena to burn them. We're not going to give them any remains of these precious remains of their loved ones. It was just to spite the Christians. But the pagans talk about doing it for that particular reason, because of the Christian burial practices, which were very different from pagan, the way they honored, you know, the bodies and that kind of thing. So that's a little insight on those particular practices. Now, music is kind of an intriguing one to us. That little passage in Ephesians 5 where it talks about psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, and there's been a lot of ink spilt on trying to distinguish those three. Rather difficult to comprehensively get a handle on all that. It certainly points to a diversity of ways that we can musically lift our voices into praise. We find in the book of Revelation, the heavenly singing, there are musical instruments there, the harps. And it appears that the lyre and the harp may have been used in some of the ancient practices of worship. Simple musical instruments, and also we'll find later choirs were introduced. But congregational singing was a big part in the early time. And again, the same kind of thing. Any of the musical instruments that were distinctly associated with pagan worship were typically banned or frowned upon in worship. Now let me just make this footnote comment, because everybody's raising in their minds, well, what about what we've done today? Well, I'm old enough to have lived through the era when electric guitars and drums were introduced to worship. The great Larry Norman and Randy Stonehill, still living, Larry Norman, recently passed away. He was the innovator. Long blonde hair to his shoulders, playing rock and roll music to the glory of God, drove lots of the church absolutely crazy. And one of his songs that was so controversial was "Why Does the Devil Have All the Good Music?" Any of you remember that one? And, you know, it was real tough in the early years. And a part of it was this very issue. Electric guitar was identified with sexuality and the glorification of immorality in rock and roll music. And what place does that instrument, because of its identity, with pagan practice in God's house? This is the exact argument that the ancients had. Now, obviously, cultures change, and there's no way the electric guitar is necessarily identified in most Christian minds necessarily with that. All there's a lot of it, if you listen to the music, still associated with that, not exclusively so, you know, at all. And every time I complain about my, you know, the songs my teenage son listens to, I just remember some of the crap I used to listen to. And there's not that much difference. Things have not changed that much. In fact, I told him not long ago, I said, you do not know how good you have it. Because your dad is old enough that I've not known a time in growing up where I didn't listen to rock and roll music. So I do not innately have a bias against the music you listen to. But I said, my parents did. My daddy made me throw my Beatles records away. He couldn't stand it. It was identified to him with a lot of evil things. And, you know, we've kind of moved beyond exclusively that identification. But I can remember in the early years, man, there were a lot of Christians didn't like Larry Norman. He didn't make a lot of friends. But now he'd be considered pretty mild. We even have Christian rap music, I understand. So we've come a long way, haven't we? Well, Well, I know I opened Pandora's box on that one. Maybe we can discuss that sometime about that. But I tell you what I really, on a serious note, I do want you to grasp as a part of this is that what we do see, like in so many of things, there is a diversity of practice among ancient Christians in the area of worship, just like there is in baptism and the Lord's Supper. And so what we see today is not, you know, so foreign to the way it was in ancient times. Now, it doesn't mean to suggest that there wasn't a push to have more and more uniformity as they were able to do it, because church leaders did believe that there's a sense in which uniformity of practice tends to unify people. And there's a practical element to this. And so liturgical text and patterns of worship were encouraged. And as you move into the later patristic period, but you do find that Christians were kind of all over the place on that. Well, meeting places, we'd all be very aware of this. The house churches, certainly the synagogues, and then as they separated from that in these small assemblies and homes of the wealthy. And it appears that the earliest places of Christian worship, and your textbook talks about some of this, were homes of the wealthy that were very large, where they just made their places available. And during times of persecution, it was very difficult to build church structures, but as soon as they were able, Christians did do that, and they tended to follow the pattern that they observed in the buildings of their culture, and erecting buildings for worship. But then there'd be other times when, just like today, the pagans would destroy those church buildings. In parts of Africa today, they cannot build them fast enough, to the Muslims will just tear them down in some parts of Africa. And you hear about that often. And so, you know, Christians just do what they have to do. Thankfully, you know, God, through His Son and through His apostles, didn't give us absolutely explicit directions about what the place where we worship ought to look like. Now, the Greek Orthodox would beg to differ with that, because they would say, well, our place, we ought to follow the Old Testament pattern, and their, you know, their cathedrals are kind of structured around the old Jewish temple. And they feel like this is the way God told His ancient people to worship, and we probably ought to worship in that same vein. The majority of the church eventually would not necessarily in there, but as they began to build these church structures, they did feel like that architecture was significant for worship. And when they had the means to build these some great edifices, if there were ways that they could emulate parts of the structure of the temple and that kind of thing, they attempted to do that. But certainly in the earliest times, they didn't have the luxury or the money to do that kind of thing at all. Well, if what I've said so far hasn't been a controversy, let's talk about women in the early church. Nobody has any opinions about that. Now, I need to make a disclaimer about this, because everybody wondered, well, what does the professor really think about these things? My particular heritage says that the ordination of women to church office is a non-essential issue. So I'm in a denomination where some churches practice it, some don't. And so I don't have ultimately a dog in this fight. I just want to tell you what the evidence is. I'm not trying to argue for one aspect or another. My job in here is just to tell you from the evidence that we have what does appear to have been the practice of the ancient church, and try to look at it, you know, fairly. And then again, you've got to make the decision, in addition to the biblical data, what value do you place on the tradition? And for some people, it has more value than others. Well, certainly women have a very prominent role in the New Testament, in the ministry of Jesus. We find how many of these women helped supported His ministry. They were present at the Pentecost in the upper room in praying. The prophecy of Joel was that your sons and your daughters will prophesy. And the Spirit was indiscriminately poured out, not only among on the apostles and the other disciples gathered there, but no distinction, male or female, the Spirit was given to everyone. And in the church of Corinth, where Paul, makes his comment about women having their head covered. Some traditions have understood that more literally than others, but it is kind of intriguing to notice, even though he says that you ought to have your head covered, they are prophesying, and he doesn't tell them to shut up. He just says, when you do prophesy, have your head covered. Kind of interesting. Lydia in Philippi. In Acts chapter 16, it seems to indicate there that the church may have been meeting in her home. This apparently was a woman of some means. Priscilla and Aquila, this husband and wife team. And Priscilla was active, according to Acts 18, in instructing Apollo. So we do have some evidence of women in the teaching role there. And then these four daughters of Philip, who are prophetesses, Acts chapter 21. Don't you wish Luke would have told us more about that? He just says, Philip had four daughters that were prophetesses. Well, isn't that interesting? What did prophetesses do? Eusebius will talk about prophetesses a little bit, and we'll talk about one of the early church movements, the Montanists, who actually had prophetesses in their midst, and it became pretty controversial. And when we talk about the Montanist, we'll do that and look at that example there. Women of the early church, what do we see in the apostolic fathers? And what evidence do we have? I've already mentioned how one of the things the pagans did to ridicule the early Christians is, it's just made up of a bunch of poor people, women, and children. Women, it's true, did not have great status in the Greco-Roman world. And one of the reasons why Paul's language in Galatians about no longer male or female, slave or free, was a direct affront to their context is within the church, all are equal before Christ. St. Cyprian, even as late as the 3rd century, he bemoans the fact, I've got so many virgins in the church, I can't even find husbands for all of them. Now, it was more costly for men to convert because they may very well have lost their livelihood. Women didn't have as large a public role, in at least for the societal ramifications of conversion, it was easier for women to convert. Men had a higher price to pay in terms of their societal, cultural status there. So there are a number of different reasons why the huge numbers of women. But you know, you hear ministers still whine about that today. That, you know, if you look in the churches, sometimes churches have more women than men in them. And apparently that was the case in some corners of the ancient. That's not always the case, but sometimes it's there. I think part of it is men's stupid pride sometimes, and maybe women have more horse sense on the human level in their response to the stirrings of the Holy Spirit as God does bring them into the church. But there are so many godly women as there were then and certainly are today. The spiritual zeal and the ministry of the women to help the poor. Now Paul, interesting, he mentions Phoebe in Romans chapter 16, verse 1. He talks about Phoebe, the deaconess. Some of the versions translate it as a servant of the Lord, but it is the word diakonos. And of course you have that debate about whether there were women deaconesses. When Paul talks about that, he talks about the male deacons, and then he says, and the women likewise. Is he talking about the wives or a distinctive? But the reality of it is that there were, from the evidence from the early church, is there were women deaconesses that were set apart. They were called that. And interestingly, it was more prominent in the Eastern Church than the Western Church. And for some reason, as you move into the 3rd and 4th century, you don't have references to deaconesses anymore. So, we really don't know what the answer to that is. Some have suggested that, you know, as the church went public after the time of Constantine, because of the lower status of women in society, that it was not appropriate for their society to have women in any kind of public leadership roles, and so maybe this is the reason in the Western Church, you know, that no longer did they have deaconesses. But the Eastern Church continued to have that practice. And then probably the most intriguing one of all, and I know all of you wish we could debate this and hammer it out, and I do not purport to have all the answers on these things, is the translation of the name of this apostle who is mentioned in verse 7 of Romans 16. Is it Junia or Junius? Different texts have different things. Is this a female apostle or not? But then we're back to the question, what was the role of apostles anyway? They certainly weren't considered to be equivalent in authority to the 12 of the immediate disciples of Christ. They had a distinctive role as the pillars of the church. And all the fathers acknowledge that. You know, whether it was male or female, what does it mean? But Paul says, and we acknowledge Junia or Junius as among the apostles. Now, there's some different traditions which emerged. And my guess is you probably never heard of some of these. And a number of the fathers raised some questions about this. There's one old legend about a Christian, a woman by the name of Catherine of Alexandria, who was a great apologist. And she at one point, according to the tradition, debated 50 pagan philosophers. And a number of them were converted, that she died as a martyr. Although, as a number of the fathers point out, some of the earliest references to Catherine of Alexandria were not until the 8th century. So there's not a whole lot of substantive data behind this tradition. Did this lady really exist, Catherine of Alexandria? We don't know. The other one, which has a close connection to St. Paul, is the legend of St. Thecla. Bet you never heard of her. St. Thecla. Put her name up here. She, according to the tradition, was a disciple of St. Paul and traveled with him. Shared his teaching ministry and was involved in hospital work. But Tertullian, even in the second century, began to question that because he felt like that these things are really not mentioned to some of the later fathers, and we really don't know if this woman existed or not. But there is a work from the second century entitled The Acts of Paul and Thecla. Sometimes it's listed under the Acts of Paul, part of these apocryphal writings that circulated in the church, and so part of the tradition came from these writings. But at least Tertullian raised a big question mark about that. Did Catherine of Alexandria and did St. Thecla exist? Now, Eusebius, who writes his ecclesiastical history during the time of Constantine, as he goes back and collects the documents that are available to him in that first decade of the 4th century, talks about some of the prominent women and their roles, and really does it under the rubric of these three categories: rulers, prophetesses, and martyrs. And he points out how a number of queens, some of the kings in these regional smaller kingdoms, and even the wives of a few of the pagan Roman emperors were Christian converts. And in one case, we'll talk about later, she was instrumental in trying to keep her husband from persecuting the Christians. And she pushed and pushed and pushed, do not persecute the Christians. And so Eusebius talks about these prominent women in these high political positions. Eusebius mentions some prophetesses, not only the Philip's daughters, who he sees in the succession of the apostles, in other words, those that speak to the church. He'll be very critical, though, about the Montanist, that had these two prophetesses in their midst, and we'll look at that shortly. Where he puts most of his emphasis is upon the martyrs. And that's certainly where I would like to put my focus. Eusebius tells very candidly the story of some of the Christian women who set an example to a lot of men in the ancient church. And there are illustrations where the men were denying the faith and the women stepped forward to face the beast. And this is the story that Eusebius tells. Some of the great women like Blandina and Perpetua and Felicitas, great heroines of the faith. Women that didn't necessarily have, you know, public leadership roles, but were considered by their lifestyle and their martyrdom as some of the great women of faith from the ancient church. And this is what Eusebius emphasizes in his writings. Well, the whole question that emerges in modern times is really the second half of the 20th century. Some of the Protestant churches begin to reopen the question, well, should we allow women in leadership roles in the church. So it has spurned new interest in looking at the ancient church, what is the evidence there, and the debate about that. And what do we know about this? Well, I would say the primary role that we see for women in the early books of order is there were orders of deaconesses and orders of widows. You know, in the New Testament, it talks about the widows and providing for them. Paul even encourages widows to remain unmarried so you might devote yourself fully to the Lord's service. And there were even, and you know, in the ancient world, you know, people's lifespan was not great. And Christian wives had their husbands die all the time from disease, you know, sickness, accident on their manual labor, whatever it might be. There were just lots of widows. And they were concerned about it in the early church, providing for this. And one of the things that we find in the early books of order is that there were explicit directives about these widows that were put on the list. And they were called to ministry to the sick, to the poor, and the church would provide for them because of this unique calling that they had. And they were explicitly set apart as an order of widows, a unique calling in the church, as were some of the deaconesses. And so, but we don't find the evidence at all of them as presbyters or bishops. In fact, the early books of order are very explicit about this, and some of makes you wonder how you know, some of this went on, because some of the writings of the fathers and the books of order were very explicit about this, that women are not to celebrate the Eucharist. They're not to be the celebrant when we come to that, and are not to be involved in baptizing people. Although, ironically, some of the later practices, when they built these elaborate baptismal pools, they weren't as sophisticated as our present practice of immersion inside buildings, you know, in the Baptist heritage. The wives, the women and the men were baptized usually in the nude. And so the women were particularly used for baptism of other women in these pools, as that was practiced. So they did participate in that way. But the bishop always had to be present to confer the rite of confirmation in that kind of thing. So we've got to, you know, these little tidbits about the role of women in these orders, though, talk about how the women, though, should be you know, involved in ministry to the sick. In some places they're you know, prohibited from you know, teaching ministry, but there are other places where they're exhorted to be involved in catechizing, particularly other women. So you see kind of a carryover there. Now, lest you just take my word for it, let me just cite from a few writings here, and you can take it for what it's worth. Tertullian, 2nd century, early 3rd century, made this statement in a little treatise he wrote entitled On the Veiling of Virgins. There were also orders of virgins in the church. There were some women, young women, that took a public vow, I'm going to remain single and give my life to the service of the church. And they were also set apart for service. And Tertullian, though, says this about On the Veiling of the Virgins. He says, it is not permitted to a woman to speak in church, neither may she teach, baptize, offer, or claim for herself any function proper to man, least of all the sacerdotal office, that is, administering the sacraments. So Tertullian was pretty strong of that. Epiphanius in the 4th century says, never from the beginning of the world has a woman served God as a priest. By that time, the nomenclature priesthood was used. And then one of their very prominent works, the Apostolic Constitutions of the 4th century. We do not permit our women to teach in the church, but only to pray and hear those that teach. For our Master and Lord Jesus Christ, when He sent us the 12 to make disciples of the people and the nations, did nowhere send out women to preach. Well, this is the exact argument that Roman Catholics, you know, make about this, and as they point to the tradition and the fact that the 12 apostles were male and that kind of thing. For This is an interesting one. For if it had been necessary for women to teach, he himself first commanded those also to instruct the people with us. And then it also says this. But if in the foregoing constitution we have not permitted the women to teach, how will we allow them, contrary to nature, to perform the office of the priest? Well, this is one of the ignorant practices of the Gentile atheism, to ordain women priests to the female deities, not one of the constitutions of Christ. For baptism were, listen to this argument, for baptism were to be administered by women, certainly our Lord would have been baptized by his own mother and not by John. For when he sent us to baptize, he would have sent along with us women also for this purpose. But now he is nowhere, either by constitution or by writing, delivered to us any such thing. So the question is, what are we to make of all of this? You know, what value should we give to these testimonies? Those that lean more toward a positive evaluation of the ordination of women like to look at these things and say, well, you got to consider the ancient culture in which they lived and their prejudice. Were they dealing with difficulties, you know, among some of the women, and so they had to kind of ratchet up the rhetoric about this and keeping women in their place? Others would argue, well, the church fathers are just articulating what explicitly what they saw in the pastoral epistles. And this was a practice to limit the office of presbyter and bishop, in particularly, to males. And so this is a part of the tradition that is handed down. And so, you know, this whole discussion, you know, comes back into play in latter times as people are trying to ask that that question. You know, how ought we to look, you know, at these things? So, but the evidence is there if you want to look at it, and it seems overwhelmingly that the testimony of these early books of order was to limit the priestly office, as they like to describe it, particularly in the functions related to the sacraments, to men. But yet they certainly had many different active roles in which women participated: the virgins, the widows, and the deaconesses. And one of the things that contemporary Christians are beginning to ask this question again is, particularly when you move into the post-Constantinian time, you see a proliferation of church office. They're wanting to give more and more people official roles in the church. We can talk about what does it mean to be ordained, to be set apart to particular ministry, but maybe we've lost a little bit of sense of that, of setting more people apart according to their giftedness to specific tasks. And the early church seemed to be very aware of this. This is important to people, that with their giftedness and people that make public commitments, that I'm going to give my life to this kind of thing, that they were commissioned. Much like, you know, we commission people to go to the mission field or mission trips or specific tasks. But are there appropriate ways that we set people apart by the laying of on of hands and prayer? It doesn't always have to be, quote, ordination to an official church office. Maybe it's appropriate to do that on in some instances, maybe it's not, but this is very much a lively issue that continues to be something that Christians struggle with. If you're interested to know, I'll just tell you where I've kind of come down on this, and it may sound kind of odd to you. I'm convinced the more and more I have looked at the issue, while I believe that the preponderance of the biblical evidence does point to the limitation of certain offices in the church to women, I do think a biblical argument can be made for leadership roles of women. But I would say the tradition trumps that. Because the consistent testimony of the tradition, it seems to be rather uninterrupted from the early centuries that indeed primary male leadership has been the practice in an uninterrupted way all the way from the earliest church all the way up to today. So, but you know, for a lot of Christians, the tradition's not that important. We're just going to have the battle just in the midst of the New Testament discussion, and that's certainly worthwhile. But it seems like to me, and I'll just throw this out, and it applies not only to this area, but I think all areas of the practice of the church. My sense of, is at least the rule I try to practice, unless there is overwhelming exegetical evidence to the contrary, we ought to typically be inclined to continue the practices of the ancient church. But if there's overwhelming exegetical evidence why we ought to jettison that tradition, we ought to do so. And that seems to be what the mainstream reformers were about. And you just think about that in your own ministry and in your particular denomination and tradition or local church, how that might play out for you. But at least that's the rule of thumb I have tried, you know, to use as I think about that. So when I come to apply it to here, you know, there's very little argument that you can make based on the tradition. Whatever you think about some of those more controversial little tidbits in the New Testament, do we understand it this way or that way? The tradition's pretty clear, pretty straightforward, and you know, the documents say what they say.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.